Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Welcome to another episode of Why Would You Tell Me That with me, Neil Delamere, and him, Dave Moore, where we try and explain stories and facts and trivia that you haven't heard before, hopefully, but you should know. And it's Dave's turn this week to wow me. We should also say that we are proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. And I blew his mind last week. So the metal glove has been spirited to his beachfront home in Port Marnock. I have slapped him around the face and I demand knowledge satisfaction.
I shall give you satisfaction, sir. In fact, not just you. I think today I'm going to speak to a huge amount of people who maybe feel a little bit, you know, elbowed out of society, a little bit isolated, maybe a little bit alone. Today, Neil, I'm going to explain in part two. Well, I'm not. Somebody very qualified is going to explain in part two why you might want to harm your partner for chewing loudly, and it's not actually your fault.
You know, it's all about whether something is relatable in terms of how it gets shared. I think this may well be our most shared episode ever. I think headphones will be thrust in the direction of partners and told to listen to this, I would imagine.
Yeah. Well, actually, because the person we're going to speak to in part two is an incredible lady. Her name is Dr. Jane Gregory. She's a clinical psychologist. She's a doctoral research fellow at Oxford University.
Oh, wow.
And she is the author of a book called Sounds Like Misophonia. So we're going to investigate misophonia. We're going to investigate what it is. Some people will go, I've heard of that. Some people will go, I've no idea what you're talking about. And then they'll hear it described and go, wait, I have misophonia. Yeah. So that's what we're going to do in part two. It is an utterly fascinating and severely under-researched phenomenon. And Dr. Jane Gregory is at the forefront of the research into misophonia. Why it happens, how you can, I won't say treat it, but how you can adapt to it, live with it, and in some cases, reprogram your brain with her techniques.
So basically, put down the hammer. If you thought the easiest way to do this was to knock all the person in your life's teeth out, hold.
There are other ways.
Let's talk. Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I figured in part one, what we would do is we would investigate sounds, because we're going to do that in part two. And I'm not going to go near any annoying sounds because that's kind of the realm of part two. But I did think I'd talk about some loud sounds in part one. Okay. So we're going to get onto the natural world. We're going to deal with the loudest animals on Earth. Have you any idea what it might be? Now, we did include one of the top 10 in an episode before.
We did something, some sort of shrimp or something that fires a noise or has
very
a gun.
Very good.
Or
Neil,
a drone.
Has the gun. Yeah, yeah.
A symbol. Or is it when a small shrimp has been at a cocktail party and drops the name of another, and that clang is the loudest? I was talking to SpongeBob SquarePants. Bang, and then that reverberates around the undersea kingdom. It's something like that, wasn't it?
You're not far off. Okay, so the loudest animals on Earth, pretty much, certainly the top three are underwater. That's for
okay.
sure. One of them is the shrimp we spoke of before. We'll get to him. The other is, we spoke as well, actually, if you remember the episode on how heavy metal people are happier. Remember that? Heavy metal fans are happier and kinder and softer people than the rest of society. The Howler Monkey. Do you remember that we played a little bit of Howler Monkey and how he sounded like a death metal vocalist going... Well, the Howler Monkey is in the top 10, okay?
Yeah.
So, well, I'll just give you the rundown real quick, okay? So, okay. North American bullfrog can achieve 119 decibels, okay? And you kind of think of a big frog and the nighttime call, the distance it must travel to attract a mate. It's so loud, but it does make some kind of sense, that frog.
Okay.
The 1 decibel higher is the African cicada. So, effectively a cricket.
Yeah.
Can make 120 decibels of sound, Neil.
How?
With its legs. So the way crickets make sound is that they rub their legs together, much like a violin bow. And that's what you hear. When you kind of are in a foreign country and it's nighttime and you hear the kind of sound of cicadas or crickets, that's what they're doing. That was a pretty good sound, right?
I mean, I thought it was the cicadas coming to the party on a helicopter. That's what it sounded like.
Yeah, well.
I was like, this is amazing, these lads. They've gotten to a level that they're not even flying themselves. So they just rub their legs off.
They just rub their legs together. That's how they make that sound, yeah? And they can reach 120 decibels. That is so immense. That's louder than a Slipknot concert, Neil. That's loud, right?
Right.
Then the northern elephant seal can reach 126 decibels. That is a cry, a guttural kind of noise it makes, and it comes from a vocal scenario like we're familiar with. 126.
I want a kiss from a rose! That sort of thing.
How did you do? I mean, I thought my cicada was good, but that is literally the sound that they make.
Heidi!
Yeah. Then there's the Moluccan. So we're on to birds now for a second. Okay. And I'm going to play you one of the sounds. The Moluccan cockatoo reaches 129. Yes, I know. Reaches 129 decibels. But the kakapos, okay, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. The kakapos reaches 132 decibels. Okay. And this is what the kakapos sounds like. Sounds a little bit like me getting up out of a chair and my bones and joints are creaking as I advance in years.
It sounds like someone trying to blow up a balloon that they don't have the lung capacity for. Come on, Janet. This birthday party starts in 25 minutes. It's meant to be a surprise.
Okay, but the terrifying thing about that is that can reach 132 decibels.
What sort of animal are we talking about here?
That is a little bird. So it's a kakapos, okay? It's a kakapos bird. We're going to get onto more weird birds in a minute, but I want to continue this list. The Howler Monkey comes in next at 140 dBs. We've heard him. We know what it sounds like. Then we go to this creature, which is the Greater Bulldog Bat, okay? This is what the Greater Bulldog Bat sounds like.
It's playing Laser Quest.
Yeah, it sounds pretty innocuous, right?
It's running around Kulak.
Yeah.
Go get down.
But it is the same volume level as the Howler Monkey because it needs to use this as echolocation. So it bursts out at such a high volume and then bounces the echo back, obviously, and creates a 3D map inside the brain of the bat. That's how all bats do it. Use their sonar that way. But it's so loud. Now, it's not the kind of thing that even if you heard it, it's so instantaneous and short-lived that it wouldn't. You would think it's very loud, but I don't think you would think it's quite as loud as it is at 140 dBs.
I'm assuming that none of these animals are in the same vicinity at the same time, are they?
Well, I doubt howler monkeys and those bats or the cicadas are. Why? What are you thinking?
I'm just thinking that is loud.
If there were three of them going at the same time.
Look, well, okay, so the elephant seal isn't going to be anywhere near them, obviously.
But sure.
Some of these animals presumably
They could do, competing with
each other.
Yeah, certainly the birds, a lot of the birds tend to be in African and Austrian Australian forests. Australian forests. And certainly I would imagine they could compete for the loudest sound in the forest. We're going to go underwater then, okay, for the top three, okay? So let's see if I can get this right. So this is what a blue whale sounds like, okay? The biggest animal in the world. So probably not, you know, unsurprising that it can make a very, very loud sound. We're up at 188 decibels. Okay, so actually, you know what? I need to tell you about this sound level. Okay.
Yeah, do.
So if we were to reach 150 decibels.
Yeah.
As a human being, it would rupture your eardrums. 150 decibels. So no creature on our list so far has gotten that high. The bulldog bat is about 140. The howler monkey about the same. The kakapo's 132. But if it got to 150 decibels, it would rupture your eardrums. There's no proof of this, but scientists estimate that between 180 and 200 decibels would kill you. The reason is it would, first of all, it would collapse your lungs.
What?
Yeah, the vibrations would collapse your lungs.
Okay.
And eventually, at a certain level, it would actually destroy the soft tissue of your brain. So there is a creature, in fact, there are two creatures that could do this to us. And we're going to get to them. So the blue whale, first of all, sounds a bit like this.
Oh, wow.
I'm just thinking, right? Imagine if you were a sailor.
Yeah.
Right? I'm talking about...
frequently do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Imagine you picture yourself there. But picture yourself as a sailor pre the discovery of things like, you know, classification of whales. You're just out at sea. You know, go back to... I mean, Neil, you've studied Vikings a lot, right?
You can call me Ishmael. Yeah.
Ishmael, yeah. Okay. So go back to before we knew what was under the water, and we only know a tiny bit as we know. Imagine hearing that at night. Nowadays, people sleep to whale song and they go, oh, I couldn't possibly sleep without my whale song. Then these lads were bolt upright in bed and their boats going, something is attacking us. It doesn't make sense.
I think the only thing more scary than that is if you heard that noise and you looked down and you had an erection. If for years you were living your life as you just nothing would affect it, you were on the sea for years, you were a salty old sea dog, and you hadn't seen any action down there, and then you heard that and you looked down and periscope was up, I think that would be absolutely terrifying. What a kink that would be. Imagine you had to ring somebody. There's only one thing that does it for me. Don't worry, the psychologist says, don't worry, what is it? I just can't help it.
No.
I call my penis Moby. But presumably now, that noise that you're hearing there, right, is underwater and travels underwater. So we wouldn't hear that if we were underwater. It wouldn't smash your brain and turn your arse inside out.
No. That's where you're wrong. I will agree with you. Whale song like that, which is what the blue whales do that makes that very loud, 188 decibels. Wow. Yes, you are now potentially dead. That is underwater, and it's over a distance. Now, if you were right beside it, I think you probably would rupture your eardrums. That may cause you issues, but I don't think it's going to kill you in the way that the loudest sound on earth will kill you.
Would that whale noise rupture all humans' eardrums if we were right beside it?
All 8 billion of us at once.
No, but any human, I should say. If any human was beside that.
Yes. I would suggest yes. Even under the water where sound travels differently, that would happen.
Enya.
Well, maybe not Enya.
I mean, Enya clearly communes with the whales on a kind of a cellular level. She's swimming beside them, sampling them. I'm gonna make a fortune off this and live in a castle.
And they also know, you see, they know Enya. So when she's in the water with her sampling equipment, they just tone the volume down a bit.
Yeah.
It's when she leaves you're in danger. Now, you mentioned the shrimp. You may remember in an episode we talked about the animal with the strongest punch in the world.
Yes.
Which is the mantis shrimp, an absolutely gorgeous creature. We said it in that episode. I'll say it to you again. Google a mantis shrimp. The most colorful, delightful thing you can imagine. Its punch is so powerful that if it wanted to, it could punch through the glass of the aquarium it's in or the tank it's in. It just doesn't know that that's how much power it has, but it does have that much power. It can reach 200 decibels. And if you remember the episode, it's not that the mantis shrimp physically punches the other fish.
Yeah.
It creates a sound wave that travels through the water and stuns the fish or whatever it wants to eat so that it can then go and grab it and eat it.
How does it create the sound wave?
With its fist. With its fist. So it punches the water creates a sound of 200 decibels, and it's those sound waves that stun its prey that it can then go and eat. Now, I have the sound of it. And when I tell you it is the least impressive sound you've ever heard in your life, even though it's the second loudest thing that is can be made by the natural world, this is what it sounds. Now, this is a captive mantis shrimp punching a metal tongs, okay? Okay, here we go. Here we go. That little clip sound.
It's a clip of a pen as it goes into a pocket protector of somebody on The Big Bang Theory.
That's exactly what it sounds like. And that is the second loudest sound created in the natural world. 200 decibels.
See, when you said that it creates a sound that's 200 decibels, I'd forgotten that it does it with the punch.
Yeah.
And it does it to hunt, doesn't it?
That's right. So
I think it would be much cooler if it just shouted. It shouted the name of whatever it was. Fish! Like that.
Jerry!
No, that's even dark, because then you assume that he's established a relationship with the fish he's about to hunt.
He knows.
And he's going to betray him.
Or if you think about it, if I came up behind you and shouted Jerry at 200 decibels, even if your name wasn't Jerry, you'd still turn around.
Well, would I turn around, or would you, it just look like you were looking at the back of my head and the front of my head because my brain had melted?
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, wow.
Okay, but on to the loudest sound in the natural world.
Okay.
This is created by an animal called the sperm whale. And the sperm whale, you'll know, the shape of the sperm whale, it has this absolutely enormous head. Its head, in fact, can be a third of its body size. And these lads can be 7 meters long, right?
Like Harry Maguire.
Yeah. Microwave Harry with his microwave head.
Harry Maguire's, his head is a third the size of his body.
Well, so is a sperm whale. But this is the reason why sperm whales have such massive heads, is to make this sound. Now, again, this is the loudest sound you can possibly hear, created by a living thing, and this is what it sounds like.
It's Woody the Woodpecker meets Predator.
Yeah, it's not massively impressive, I will give you that. However, it's that 200. Can be 233 decibels. Now, go with me with this for a second.
How do you measure that?
There are decibelometers. There are things that you can actually measure.
Operated by who, though? Like, I mean, surely a human is. No, have you, we trained other whales?
No.
Have we trained other whales? Because otherwise, the human's brain would go into mush. Surely there's a selection of animals that can do. Like, the only one who can measure this is a howler monkey. And the only one who can measure a howler monkey.
It would have to be a deaf creature that can only measure, not something that can shout loudly. No.
Okay.
No, obviously, we can drop probes into the ocean and we can hear these sounds and measure their volume. Right. But here's what it does, right? So imagine the big, long head of the sperm whale, which, by the way, as a just complete irrelevant point of interest, it is the largest creature on the earth with serrated teeth.
Right, okay.
There you go. So what it does is it actually forces air into its right nostril.
Yeah.
And then shoves that backwards, not out of its head, into its head.
Okay.
It runs by a series of air-filled sacs, and then there's a part of the whale's body called, this is amazing, Neil, called monkey lips, which is my online nickname on my OnlyFans, if anyone wants to come find me.
Monkey lips. Okay.
But the monkey lips, they clamp shut, and the air is then bounced off the sacs, which make this sound. But what it does to make it loud is the back of it, the reason its skull is so big is the back of its skull is like a massive satellite dish. So the air travels there, goes past the air-filled sacs, the monkey lips shut closed, it hits the satellite dish, then the sound travels forward off the satellite dish and eventually leaves the head, and that is 233 decibels. Remember, at 150, your eardrums rupture and death will occur between 180 and 200. So 233 decibels would absolutely annihilate you.
And is this all sperm whales, or is this, like, I imagine it being the builder sperm whales, the ones you have to go, who built your last one? It's that
the mechanic. Oh, this is going to need a lot of work.
Oh God! That noise you can hear there—that's me monkey lips flapping.
So divers have said that when they have been in the vicinity of sperm whales who have been communicating with each other, of their monkey lips, they can feel their entire bodies vibrating at those clicking noises. Not some shout, not some whale sound. It's literally that tick, 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 tick. And their entire bodies vibrate. And they do tend to leave the water. Now, the maximum volume that a sperm whale can reach, it's not trying to do that on a daily basis. It's not trying to do that near the surface. That's used really deep down low. Again, echolocation, trying
what
to find prey.
Wonder?
Well, they're trying to find prey. So they hunt in complete darkness.
Right.
And they eat sharks, they eat a squid, giant squid, anything basically. They
dogs.
Well, there are no dogs a kilometre down into the sea, as far as I know.
It's what essentially they're doing, isn't it? They're just really big dogs.
Really big
underwater
dogs.
That's what it seems
dogs.
Like to me. So, but presumably, so, like, howler monkeys also use monkey lips to make their long noise, their loud noise.
Yeah, but
you're going to tell me that inside a howler monkey's brain is a thing called whale nostrils?
No. Okay. Definitely not. I will, however, move off the animal world for a second and bring you to space. Space is always a great place to go when you're talking about weird stuff, right? So, a strange sound that NASA recorded. NASA recorded a distant galaxy.
Yeah.
And they knew there was a strange sound emitting from it. And they went and recorded the strange sound. Look, what they do with these things in space is they have to pitch them up to levels that we can hear. So they usually pitch things up, 50% or 500% or even 1,000%, whatever. And they go, oh, that's what it kind of sounds like. And often it sounds like synthesizer music and stuff. It's a bit weird.
Yeah.
They pitched this sound. They couldn't get it to be audible until they pitched it over 1,000,000%, Neil. Okay.
Right.
This is the sound of a black hole oscillating.
Oh, that is the noise that you hear when the lift cable snaps.
Yeah.
That's what it is, isn't it?
In the Burj Al Arab. The Burj Al Khalifa. You already covered 300 floors.
Yeah, you're trying to think, if I jump right at the last minute, I think that's how I survive pancakes.
As the steel box shuts in on itself. But yeah, that is insane, that sound. And there's loads of them in space I could have done. But
I thought you can't hear anything in space, though, I thought.
No, space, yeah, so there's a couple of theories about that. I think we've covered them actually before on the podcast. But yeah, this logic that you can't hear anything in space is accurate to a point. Yes, sound does not travel in a vacuum the way it travels here on Earth with an atmosphere. But no, if something makes a noise in space, it can be heard in its immediate vicinity. It just doesn't travel a distance, if that makes sense. But it can be heard. It does make a noise in its location, wherever it is, it will make a noise. But birds are absolutely ridiculous in the sounds they make. We know that. I mean, did we ever cover the lyre bird on the...
I don't know if we've covered it, but the one that can do car alarms and chainsaws and amazing.
And of course, the clicking noise of a camera, because it's often been photographed in the wild, whatever. They're amazing. But listen to this, okay? This is called a great patu. What this fella sounds to me like is he's had an amazing night.
Yeah.
The alarm has gone off and he's gone, ah. And then he makes one of my favorite sounds in the world, which is when people with a strong gag reflex, you say something to them that triggers it and they go, they instinctively just go, that sound. Yeah. And actually anyone misophonia is now giving out to us because that sound probably triggers them. But listen to him. It's really what he sounds like.
Yeah, he's woken up, he's been a night on the beer, he's gone, and then he's remembered something he said to his boss.
Yeah.
Oh god.
No.
I told him my fact about sperm whales monkey lips. And then I did the mime. I can't believe I did the mime. So if we did Free Willy's Planet of the Apes.
Wow.
Free Willy Planet of the Apes with the monkeys doing the soundtrack featuring Enya. We could have all these sounds.
You're always capitalizing and trying to make money on this.
I'm just trying to get one of them to sponsor us.
Income streams. Yeah. This is a southern cassowary.
That's a fucking tiger.
if I told you that was any other mammal, anything big, a rhino, a tiger, a warthog, exactly, that's what you would think. No, that's a bird.
Yeah, but aren't they the vicious ones that live
They're
in...
They're insane looking.
Where do they live? Cabra or something. There's... They're out Cabra Fimsborough somewhere, aren't they?
There's another fellow I love, and he's called... I've got to get his name right here. Hang on. He is called...
Are they in Australasia, are they?
Yes, cassowaries are. Yeah, okay. yeah. Big, weird, colourful, strange, angry-looking fellas. There's something called a Gunnison sage grouse. Like, I mean, first of all, what an amazing name. Second of all, how
is it? Is that it as it's been dropped into a pan?
How does it not sound like it's a bubbling pot of potatoes?
Yeah. I mean, if there's anything that could make something sound more delicious, it's that. I mean, is there another a grouse that sizzles like it's on a pan with basil and coriander and well seasoned or something, is there?
But my favorite though, Neil, is a bird called, and this is hilarious, it's called the grey go away bird.
No, it's right? not.
No, it is. It is. And this is why. This is why.
It's a fella that you met down at the shops, and you're telling him a story about the fact that you woke up and you told your boss about the monkey nits, and he goes, "Gooey, gooey!"
It's me. Mrs. Doyle has been given the day off by Father Ted. It's either that or a teenage girl, and the next line is, "You don't know my life." Gooey!
One more time.
You've opened the door in the bedroom. Where is that?
I don't know where the grey go. It has to be Australia.
It does.
Because the reason is not because of the bird, not because of the way it looks, but because of the thing it's named.
Yeah, the grey.
Aussies are amazing.
Desert.
They just go, the grey. What do we call this fella? Oh, the fella says guay. Call him a guay bird. Yeah, the grey guay bird. Yeah, perfect, mate.
He would be a terrible zoo exhibit, wouldn't he? Just and this is our shyest animal.
numbers are down. I don't know what entrance numbers are down. Any ideas why? Could it be the flock of great Gouay birds we put at the first door when you went in?
It's beside that. Will you stop, monkey? Will you stop?
Okay, well, how about...
Go on out of that, badger. Go on out of that. How will you stop? Go away.
The loudest sound
yes.
ever experienced by humans, right?
Is when I dropped a pint glass in Flanagan's. The loudest sound ever experienced by humans.
Now this...
I can guess.
Go on.
Is it Krakatoa?
It is Krakatoa.
Is it?
You are a smart man. I do love when you do this.
Wow.
Yeah. Krakatoa, 1893.
Now, was it the actual eruption or was the whales passing on the news?
The sperm whales were telling the blue whales who told the mantis shrimp. No, it was the actual explosion. So it was, the actual measurement from 100 miles away.
Wow.
Was 172 decibels, Neil.
From 100 miles
away? From 100 miles away was 172 decibels, right? So there's actually no way of really gauging what the decibel reading was of the sound itself. But it obliterated more than half of the island's landmass as soon as it went off. The tsunami, you may remember, and it's a terrible thing, but if you've ever seen the video of the tsunami in Southeast Asia that happened.
Yeah.
You'll see that the waves, the size of the waves aren't that particularly threatening looking. They're not bigger than houses. They just keep coming. The water just keeps coming. Mm. It doesn't stop. The tsunami waves were 100 feet tall.
Jesus.
Right? Christ. And this is all from the explosion. It deafened everybody it didn't kill for up a radius of about 50 miles. So if you didn't die, you were deaf.
It deafened everybody within 50 miles.
Within 50 miles. In Zanzibar, which we've explained this before, Krakatoa in Southeast Asia, around Indonesia kind of area, that the Zanzibar is on the east coast of Africa.
Yeah.
And human skeletons melted onto slabs of pumice stone, washed up on Zanzibar coasts up to 9 months afterwards. Like, Jesus this Christ. Was when people were in New Guinea and even parts of Australia, they heard gunfire, what they thought was gunfire. That was Krakatoa.
That must have been utterly terrifying.
Yep. Imagine, like, whatever about hearing gunfire in Australia, being outside of, like, immediate death radius, but hearing a sound that was the equivalent, they reckon, to 200 megatons of TNT.
Mother of God. I mean, presumably, if you were very close to it, it goes off with this huge, and you're deafened, and you, like, it's so immediate, like, you don't even know what has deafened you.
No idea, exactly. It just happens. You're like, it's terrifying.
Wow.
God, however, I did.
Properly terrifying.
It is, but I did find the second loudest sound in my research. It was made in 2003 in an apartment in Charlotte Quay in Dublin, Dublin 4. And it was when I was asleep. In my bed, because I worked on breakfast radio, so I used to get up at about 4 o'clock in the morning. So I went to bed at about 9:30. My wife went out for some drinks. My girlfriend at the time went out for some drinks.
How very enlightened your wife went out with your girlfriend.
Yeah. So
Leia.
She went out for drinks. I went to sleep because I was a good boy and wanted to get up early. And then I woke up, I was really, really thirsty. I mean, like, one of those just weird wake up, like, oh, I have to get a drink. So again, I'm kind of middle of the night, probably nearly my alarm time. So I'm just kind of just get up and get a drink. All the lights are off. I'm not even going to like open my eyes. I'm stumbling down the hall. And as I got closer to the kitchen, I realized the lights were on. And I was like, oh, why are the lights on? And then as I got where the hall opened up into the kitchen diner thing that apartments have, somebody was there. Yeah. And Neil, I let out a sound that Tracy to this day mimics, because not only did I let out the second loudest sound that's ever been heard since Krakatoa, it was this sound. This is her version of what happened. My knees buckled, and I ended up on the ground. Her big, fit, late 20s, prime of his life, protector man went, and buckled his knees and fell on the ground. And to this day, she has never looked at me the same.
You know that a CIA thing that was the men who stare at goats? If you stare at goats, you could make them. Isn't it kill them, isn't it?
Yeah.
Dave Moore, if you frighten him, he has a reflex. It's a bizarre genetic mutation that he turns into a Victorian swooning lady. And has a fit of the vapors. This big, strong, former sprinter. With the arse, with the buttocks and thighs of Usain Bolt. No good to him. No good to him if you slightly startle him before his alarm clock.
By the way, it wasn't even midnight. She wasn't even out that late. I'd only been asleep for about 2 hours.
It was 6 o'clock. The Angelus is the thing that did it to him. It was a bong and someone looking into the middle distance in a kind of ruminative way. And Lady Godiva there. No, Lady Godiva too long. Lady, what was the wooden...
Lady Chatterley?
No, she was the fellow who rode the gardener in the shed. Lady... I can't remember. Lady Windermere. I'm going to go
All
for
right,
Lady
there Windermere. You go. Yeah, that'll do. Right, well, look, let's wrap up part one there and get ready for our guest in part two. She is phenomenal. Dr. Jane Gregory is going to tell us why you might want to harm someone you love for chewing loudly, but it's not actually your fault.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, welcome back to part two of Why Would You Tell Me That? And we are joined now by Dr. Jane Gregory, clinical psychologist, doctoral research fellow at Oxford University, and author of an amazing book called Sounds Like Misophonia. Jane, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I did tell Neil in part one that I would explain in part two why you might want to harm your partner for chewing loudly, but it may not actually be your fault.
Yeah, you personally, just, you know, those urges.
Yes. And they are real and they do exist and people do feel them. And I think that actually is one of the things that came across in your book so well, is the feeling of community and the feeling of people finally finding, you know, people maybe not like-minded, but literally like-minded people, people with the same brains as them, but they may not have had a sense of community before or a sense of even a definition of what it is. So can you explain to everybody, including Neil, what misophonia actually is?
So misophonia is an extreme or intense reaction to certain sounds that where the volume isn't so much the problem, but it's kind of the nature of the sounds, either the sort of acoustic pattern of the sound or the personal meaning of the sound to the person. So most commonly that includes things like chewing noises, slurping, clearing your throat, sniffing repeatedly, clicking pens, ticking clocks, anything that's repetitive and sort of intrudes on your auditory space and therefore intrudes on your emotions.
Right. But let's talk about the name, because misophonia is of Greek origin, but I love the fact that, Neil, it's got something to do with soup. Can you explain that?
The term misophonia, it was named by this couple, a married couple, the Jastroboffs, who they were working with tinnitus, and then they kept seeing this pattern of patients who were coming to see them who were always bothered by the same sort of particular sounds of eating and breathing. And they didn't have tinnitus and they didn't have hyperacusis, which is when you're bothered particularly by louder sounds or sounds sound louder than they are. And they wanted to come up with a word for it. And so they got a linguist to help them and came up with all the sort of root pairings of words to try and come up with it. And they picked misophonia because it's miso is for hatred and phonia for sound, but partly just because that one of them really loved miso soup. And so he picked the description that sort of, it doesn't quite match the description. And he has said it's not intended to be taken literally because people don't actually hate sounds. And there are some sounds that people really love and may even have a really strong positive emotional reaction to.
Sure.
So is some of it a degree of a kind of a Madeleine, you know, that idea that like a Madeleine is if you have, say you had jam sandwiches when you were a kid, then you have jam sandwiches when you're 35, you're suddenly 7 or 8 again. Is it a kind of a reverse of that? You have a noise that really, sometimes it really affected you as a child or affected you as an adult, and it's that noise? Is that sometimes the case?
It can be, yeah. So it can be something where it might be, the sound might be attached to a particular memory or a particular time in your life, a transition in your life. So a lot of people develop it around the beginning of adolescence. There's sort of a couple of times, like around 8 or 9 or about 11 and 12, that people develop it. And those are both really key developmental phases anyway, of sort of getting some independence from your parents. And so sometimes it's just developmental that things change a little bit, how you process sounds at that stage. But sometimes it's, there might be conflict in the house, or and mealtimes are the one time where you all have to sit together and there's tension and unspoken problems that then the sounds kind of become attached to the problem.
That was a really fascinating part of the book, was hearing the experiences of, because the way the book is written is brilliant, but a part of it is that you have real life experiences and quotes from sufferers of misophonia, and they talk about, you know, throughout the books and the different chapters, they input relevant real world scenarios that they find themselves in. And a lot of them, it was very interesting to find that, say, for example, a parent may have expressed their distaste for a sound to a parent, or indeed a sibling, who then went, "Ha ha, you hate that sound. Well, then guess what I'm going to do for the next 10 years? I'll never validate your feelings, and I'll just make the sound in your ear because I'm your hilarious big brother, or your, you know, dad who doesn't really think it's a serious thing," or whatever.
Yeah. And so you can sort of understand that from a sibling, like siblings tend to torment each other. But there are people that I've spoken to who in their current adult life, fully grown adult humans, do that to them after having just been told that they get a really strong reaction to it, that it makes them panic, it makes them feel like they need to escape. And people go, "Oh, what, this sound?" And then make the sound. Yeah. Or make the sound every time they walk past them in the office or something like that. And when I first started, because I must just have pretty nice people in my life, because even if people didn't understand it, they weren't disrespectful of my feelings. And I think I'm really, really lucky that my parents, they didn't get it. They were completely baffled why I would have a pillow over my head because the pigeons outside were trying to torment me. But they always let me have the feelings. Mm. Whereas a lot of people with misophonia have been told that they're crazy, that they're too sensitive, that they're being manipulative or controlling. And so that becomes part of the emotional reaction, the sort of shame attached to that, or a fear of being humiliated by other people. Mm. And so the emotions aren't just about the sound in that moment, it's all of the memories attached to that sound, which includes what other people have done to you.
What I love about how you've just said it there in that sentence is this book is written by you, a sufferer of misophonia. So you are a misophone. There's a phrase I've never heard before, Neil, that I heard in this book, which is such a brilliant phrase, which is me search. In other words, research on a topic that affects the researcher. So you are a me searcher, James.
Exactly. Yes, and proud of it.
I'm proud of it. But what does it mean for the scientific community when somebody is a me searcher? Is that always accepted?
No, it's not always accepted. And in fact, it's kind of almost like binary, like people either love it or hate it. So a lot of people in the scientific community think that it biases the research and will influence the way you interpret things. But I think that's true of any science, and we as scientists need to be aware of our biases. Mm. And if we're aware of them and can report on those potential biases, then that becomes part of what you produce. But for people in the community who the research is intended to help, they like me search because they feel like the person is understanding their experience and is motivated by something bigger than just becoming a famous scientist or getting published, that actually they want to do something to help the community.
Yeah. During lockdown began these things on my Instagram account, and they were World Cups. And what I would do, Jane, is I would grab, like, you know, biscuits, and I would go do the biscuit World Cup. And I start with 32 different biscuits, and my fans would whittle them down until we got to the final, and it would be revealed the best biscuit is. And I just remember biscuits was the chocolate hobnob, won that one. But I also did the world's most annoying sounds. And like, wow. I'm talking, this isn't scientific, but I am talking about over 500,000 votes cast in this, right? And the one that won out was, and this is what I called it because I had to pick a name first, because it's like, you could obviously say nails on a chalkboard, people would get that, or whatever. But the one that won out was nose snot hocking. It's the only way I could describe it. But that sound, and apologies to anyone.
Sort of like back of the nose.
Taking it in. Yeah.
And then so, whatever you have to do to get rid of it.
Exactly. And you can imagine, I mean, you know the details, so you would know the percentage of...
I'm hearing it in my head right now.
With apologies to any misophonia sufferers.
Oh, we've lost them, Dave. We've lost them.
At least you're not making the sound. I restrained myself from saying, oh, you mean this sound?
Yeah, no, I was very purposely not doing that.
But, my goodness.
You know, you would know what percentage of the audience that would have been there, you know, globally, that would have suffered from misophonia. However, even in the global audience, you know, those with and without misophonia, this sound triggers people in the same way. So does the non-misophone kind of society, do we understand why people suffer so badly with misophonia?
I think it can go both ways. So I think you can kind of relate to the idea of being in the presence or being stuck with a sound that you really hate. But the nature of the reaction is different. And so if you think you understand, then that in a way distances you from the other person because you think it's like what you experience, which is that's annoying. Ugh, gross. I don't want to have to listen to that. Whereas for somebody with misophonia, the sound might be more like a rage reaction or panic, this really physical fight or flight kind of response.
Yeah.
And so we did a study in the general population and in a misophonia group, and 85% of people in the general population said they don't like the sound of loud chewing. So it's like a really normal sound. But the most common reactions in the general population were disgust and irritation. Whereas in the misophonia group, it was 99%, which is, makes sense because it's sort of a defining feature. But the most common reactions were anger and panic for the sound of loud eating.
So if these noises engender panic and anger, what do you do when you are a misophone? Is there a way for you to, and I use this because I'm kind of floundering around for the right word, but how do you treat yourself? How do you cope? Do you just remove yourself from the sound, or what techniques does somebody use when they've discovered that this is something that they experience?
The most common reaction is just to do what you can to avoid the sounds or get away from them. So most people with misophonia would carry headphones or earplugs with them. Like I often have a pair of bright orange earplugs like within reach at all time.
Right.
And so trying to not have to hear it or mute it in some way is the most common thing. And that just sort of, for most people, brings the reaction right down. But in terms of longer term change, the things that I think are really important, there's sort of layers to it. So one is that idea that it's attached to these other experiences. So we want to kind of remove the impact of these past experiences. So that might include things like just saying to yourself, like, I'm not a terrible person for finding my husband repulsive right now. Like that's just a visceral reaction, but it's not my fault and it doesn't make me a terrible person. So sort of like a validation of the feeling. And then that itself can de-intensify the reaction a little bit because you remove that feeling of shame or that maybe that fear that you'll do or say something that you're going to regret later.
What you touch on in the book, which is fascinating, is that obviously this is embedded in our neural pathways. If you have misophonia, you know, the connections have been made and you're not trying to rewire the brain, as it were. But what you're trying to do is create new and positive associations.
Yeah, that's right. So the neural pathways are there that tell you that this sound is some kind of threat or violation. It's going to cause you harm in some way. And that's the bit that we want to change. So you can find it annoying, but what we want over time is for it to change so that you feel like it's no more harmful than any other annoying sound.
Yes, okay.
And so the way that we do that is by creating new associations with the sound. And it doesn't, we're not trying to actually make you feel positive, but if you have a different, like a unique, novel, silly kind of interaction with the sound, you're more likely to, over time, have a much less intense reaction.
Yeah, that's amazing, because one of the stories from one of the people who fed into the book as a misophone talked about working in an office, and above in another office was someone who stomped on the floor. And look, we can all find that annoying, but this person couldn't concentrate. Their whole day would have been ruined. Their productivity would have been down. If the person stomped on the floor for 5 minutes in the morning, then they would be waiting on the stomp to come again and wouldn't concentrate. So it had a proper reaction within their brain and their productivity and everything. So they said, Jane, isn't it right, that they thought it was a little elephant who worked upstairs, but who was stressed out about a deadline. So they created this humorous image. So when the stomp happened, it was just this silliness around it, as opposed to the anger or the fight or flight or whatever that was affecting their productivity.
Yeah, exactly. And we call this inhibitory learning, where it sort of inhibits the old association, which is that this is harmful to me, that either it feels like it's being done deliberately or it's going to harm me in some way, and creates a new association, which is that's an annoying sound, but it's not harmful to me. And yeah, and I think he even elaborated on that. It was like he imagined it with a little waistcoat and a top hat or something like that. And the more you can put detail into that image, the more silly it is. Our brains learn much better when we feel relaxed, when we feel happy, when we're laughing. And so if you can make it funny, your brain takes on that new information. And the new information is as simple as, this isn't harming me. I hate it. I don't want to listen to it, but it's not harming me. And that's the new information. And logically, we know it, but you don't have access to that logic when you're in fight or flight mode. So you need to create these new associations so that that part of your brain can learn that it's not harmful.
That's the great thing about the book, is the fact that there are different coping strategies that you can employ to find the ones that suit you. But also then I love you have an exercise where you recommend that people remove a coping strategy to kind of do almost a scientific experiment of their own to see how they cope having employed them.
Yeah, exactly. And that idea of comparing conditions, which it's like you become your own little mini science experiment, because often our fear of what's going to happen is based on past experiences and often childhood experiences. So for me, I felt like if I didn't get away from this sound, I would snap, I would do something physically aggressive. And that's because when I was a kid, I ripped food out of my brother's hand because he refused to eat quietly. And that made me feel like I could snap at any minute and do something worse than that. But when I put that to the test, I'm a fully grown adult now. I have control over my impulses. I'm not going to do that to another person. But when I was a kid, I did. So it was true at one point, but it no longer applied. And so these experiments help you to work out, does this still apply? This fear that you have, which is probably there for a really good reason because it was probably true or likely at one point in your life, but does it still apply? And it allows you to test that.
Now, when I read this book, I felt very seen. The reason is I live with somebody who has misophonia. She is my wife, Tracy, and she definitely, when I was reading the book, I just kept picturing her. And I know, Jane, as we've said, you have misophonia, and your partner, I would imagine, would feel very seen reading the book as well, because we are often the current source of the annoyance, even though we may or hopefully not be doing this on purpose, but that our noise is because the person lives with us, because the person, you know, sits down to eat dinner with us all the time, that we may, and our children may, be the people that are creating some of the problems for misophonia sufferers.
Yeah, absolutely. I really feel for the partners of people with misophonia, because they are constantly being told or shown that they are disgusting and that they shouldn't be allowed to exist in polite human society. And as you say, most of the time it's not being done deliberately. And I will qualify that by saying sometimes that it is being done in a abusive way, and I'm not dismissing that, but for the most part, partners aren't doing it deliberately. It's really hard to change such embedded habits like the way you eat, the way you breathe. My poor husband, he breathes too loudly and he's trying so hard. He just can't breathe any quieter. And it's this real conflict in relationships, because it's so hard to change habits, but also the person with misophonia can't help it either. And so neither person can help it. And you have to work out what you're going to do about that.
I really hope you swing the camera and he's beside you in a snorkel. He's just been really quiet.
Is it the case that actually you and my wife, Tracy, and the other people who suffer with misophonia, are you actually superheroes in the sense that you're like the super guard of our tribe, and we need people like you? Okay, nowadays in 21st century Western Europe, maybe not. But there was a time when having somebody who could hear sounds really well was really important.
Yeah, I do think that there's some kind of evolutionary function to the fact that it's nearly one in five people have this sensitivity where they sort of can't tune out these kinds of sounds. And if you think about that in a protective way, it's those are the people who won't ignore the rustle in the grass. While the other people get on with the other things that need to be done, they're going to be the one making sure that's not a snake coming into the camp, or if you hear a sound outside the cave, it might be a lion or whatever. And you can sort of relate to that experience of if you're walking alone late at night, and you can, even if there's traffic, you can tune into the sound of someone walking behind you.
Yes.
Even though that's quieter than the traffic next to you, your brain has the capacity to do that. And there are some people who they just can't switch that off, which for the most part becomes more of a problem than a power. But I do think that we will be the ones to survive the zombie apocalypse.
You'll hear the shuffle as they make their way towards
us. We have glared at so many people with scuffing their Birkenstocks along the ground or whatever. The sound of a zombie. Oh, we are going to know.
Killed by a zombie hippie. Nobody wants that. Just, if somebody in Birkenstocks, you're fine, because they'll be the vegan zombies. They're not eating anybody's brains. You're fine at that point. And can you condition yourself to a certain degree, or is your job, does even your job kind of feed into this at all? Because this is just anecdotal, I suppose. If Dave, you're talking about your wife, my wife is brilliant, maybe because she's married to me, at tuning things out, right? But because she's working offices and she just has this ability, I have no ability at all to do that, because I have always worked on my own in quiet rooms. Does your environment play some part of it?
I think so. And I think it's bi-directional. So if you work in an office, there are some people who might develop that skill of being able to tune out those sounds. And then there's also the fact that if you are able to tune out those sounds, you're going to be more attracted to a job in an office. And if you can't, then you're not likely to go in there. For me, I think that I can relate it to, was previously more of a clinical psychologist, like a therapist, before I started doing research. And I think it helps me to tune into and detect when someone's emotion changes while we're talking. If there's a subtle change in their voice, but they're not showing any emotion yet, I go, what just happened there? I noticed that your voice changed just slightly. And I think that it's the same mechanism in the brain that allows me to detect that and not ignore that. That is the same reason I can't work in a room with a clock.
Right, okay. And are your brains actually physically different than non-misophonia brain?
They've done MRI studies, so magnetic resonance imaging, where they scan brains, and it does show differences in the connections in the brain when people are listening to misophonia sounds compared to just general aversive sounds. It's different in the brains of people with misophonia and not in the brains of people without misophonia. So there's heightened connections between sort of auditory and emotion sort of processing, and how the part of the brain where you work out whether something is meaningful or important, whether you need to pay attention to it, and the part of the brain for fight or flight and adrenaline. There's just sort of a hyperconnectivity. Yeah. But what they don't know, because all of this has just been a snapshot in time, they don't know if the brains were different to begin with and so that predisposed them to misophonia, or if the nature of having misophonia means that those pathways get strengthened over time.
Okay.
Because they're reacting to sounds. And there's no way of knowing that without longer term studies.
And is there a diagnostic test for it yet, or is it self-reported? Because we talked to the man who coined the phrase aphantasia about people who don't have a mind's eye. And for years that was self-reported. And then recently they discovered that you could measure pupil dilation, essentially. So they did figure out an actual diagnostic test. Does that exist for misophonia yet, or is it on the horizon?
There's not one that's been agreed upon, and it's not a physiological measure like that. It's not something that can be directly measured. So that's why we need to create these questionnaires to sort of measure concepts that can't be directly observed. And the part of the problem is that there's not a consensus yet on what the criteria are to say that you have this. And at what point does it become what we might think? There's one paper that suggests it should be a disorder, and it's like, well, at what point would we consider it a disorder? And I think there are a lot of people who would identify with the term misophonia and being annoyed and having a really intense reaction to these sounds, but it might not affect them on a day-to-day basis. They can sort of manage it. And so they wouldn't consider themselves to have a disorder. And so there's this question also of like, what's sort of clinical or disorder and what's a phenomenon and just something that people put up with, but it doesn't affect them so severely.
Can I catch misophonia off my wife in the sense that I would have been oblivious to all sounds, but now I'm kind of maybe slightly more hyper aware of the sounds my kids make, not because of me, but because I know it's going to make mammy a little bit irrational.
So I guess the question, Dave, is have you caught misophonia?
Yeah.
Do you believe? Yeah. No, my husband calls it misophonia by proxy.
There you go. Yes.
It started as you were describing that he would listen out to sounds that he thought would bother me. So if we went to the cinema, he'd be listening out. He's like, oh, okay, we're going to have to move in a second because someone's eating popcorn two seats away, and that he would sort of get ready to move. But now, even if we're not together, he'll be sitting on a train and he'll hear someone open a packet of crisps and he'll be like, what the hell are you doing? Like, who eats crisps on a train?
Yeah.
And that's something that would never have bothered him before.
We're conditioned. We're definitely conditioned.
Is there any part of you that, because, and you're the only person who could do this because you study it and you have it, is there any part of you that when you were recording your audiobook wanted to pick the person to narrate it who had the most annoying voice in the history of the world just for the crack?
So basically that would be doing exactly what I said before, which is like deliberately antagonizing.
You see how Neil's brain works, Jane, is what you're starting to witness now. Yeah.
In fact, I did the exact opposite. So
you had somebody who had a lovely voice.
Yeah. And we made that a criteria before we agreed on the audiobook. Was like, if we do an audiobook, we have to approve the voice of the narrator. So they sent me some samples that I listened to at first, and one was like, oh, they had a slightly hissy S, and I was like, that's going to annoy people. And so then I had a short list, and then I got other people with misophonia, particularly people who have a much stronger reaction to me but who also listen to audiobooks, because I tend not to. I got them to listen to it, and once I got their approval, then that was how we chose the person.
Is there any link between ASMR and misophonia? Like, it seems like they're almost polar opposites.
Well, the interesting thing is it's really hard to measure because a lot of the way ASMR, so if people don't know, ASMR is an audiosensory meridian response, and it's basically a sort of tingly feeling, usually considered a pleasant tingly feeling in response to sounds. And there's a huge overlap between the types of sounds that trigger people in misophonia and the types of sounds that are pleasurable for people with ASMR.
Okay.
But ASMR is the tingly response. So if you're feeling a negative reaction to the sound, then it's not ASMR. It's more likely to be misophonia. But some people have said they have both for the same sound. And sometimes the context makes a difference. Sometimes they can actually reframe it in their head and it becomes pleasurable. I don't. I get that tingly feeling I get with a few things, like some music gives me that feeling. Like if someone scratches the back of my head, I get that nice tingly feeling. But I don't, the videos that are intended for people with ASMR, I can't, I use them to help people like practice coping skills in misophonia.
Yeah,
it's so horrible. Like people just eating big plates of spaghetti and stuff. But it's more similar, but then it branches out. So the similarity is that there's a hyper connection between emotion and sound.
Right.
It's just, and so the pathway is probably the same for a bit, and then one goes in the pleasure direction and one goes in the negative. So people might be more predisposed to experience both because they have a heightened connection between sounds and emotion. But in some cases, it would be ASMR. In some cases, it would be.
Well, to wrap up, I feel like you've provided genuinely a really important lifeline to people, because I think writing a book like this, putting a name, I know you didn't coin the term misophonia, but bringing it out to the masses, I think will make a lot of people feel like, as I mentioned at the start, that there's a community of people, 1 in 5, who feel the way I feel and feel feelings of fight or flight and anger and threat. I don't like annoying sounds. We all have that, but there really is a community of people who are suffering. And if somebody's listening today and they for the first time maybe feel like they're hearing you describe what they go through, what is the best thing to do? alongside obviously buying Sounds Like Misophonia, the book by Jane Gregory.
Step one.
Yes. But I mean, but is it that you seek out therapy? Is it that you do something like read this book, for example, and try and get to the bottom of what is occurring? What is the best thing to do?
I think that for most people, reading the book will be helpful. I think having an understanding of what's going on and actually just like feeling okay about having a brain that works a little bit different to other people when it comes to sounds is part of the process. So that's the first bit, is just sort of learning a little bit about it and reframing your past experiences of thinking that you're crazy or whatever it is that people said about the way you react to sounds. And then the other part is giving yourself permission to leave the room if you need to. Like if you are in fight or flight, you don't have to fix it in that moment. Most situations, you don't have to suffer through it. If you can politely leave, do it politely. If you can't do it politely, I guess just get out anyway.
Yeah, just leave.
But don't expect yourself to be able to do anything rational or logical in that moment. Just remove yourself, calm down, and then decide what you want to do about it. And then the other part is the bit about the new associations in the book. And I think that most people can do that on their own and will come up with much better ideas than I've put in the book, because it will be personal to them.
Actually, sorry to interrupt you, but one of the things I think you put in the book, which to me would be brilliant for anybody just going through their life, is the but and scenario, the but and interchange. Can you explain that to everybody?
Yeah, so that's the idea of taking out the word from a sentence, taking out the word but and replacing it with and. So I think the example I use in the book is like, I want to be able to speak to my parents more often, but they always have snacks with them when they get on Zoom. And if you just replace the but part and say, I want to speak to my parents more and they always have snacks with me on Zoom, it opens up the possibility that something can change. Whereas if you use the word but, it's saying, therefore I can't because of this thing. And actually what we want to say is, this is how it is. These are the two circumstances. What can I do about that? And that's come from a very personal experience of my parents, who know I'm researching misophonia, know I've written a book about misophonia. They get on Zoom and they're like, oh, we're just having our pudding. Like, they listen to my interviews. They've read the book. I was like, how is this still happening?
Well, it's really nice pudding, Jane. It's really nice pudding.
Yeah, and look, we're sharing a meal together. Not into a microphone, we're not.
Yeah, yeah. Look, Dr. Jane Gregory, clinical psychologist, doctoral research fellow at Oxford University, and the author of a fabulous book, Sounds Like Misophonia, which I think might save my marriage. Thank you very much for coming on today.
For another couple of years. Anyway.
Yeah, at least.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
Welcome back to part three of Why Would You Tell Me That? Now, usually, Neil, when we cover a topic, you know, we might get into part three and I might, you know, perhaps make some noises if we were talking about noises with my mouth and make a joke or something. But I think given the fact that this episode will be titled Misophonia, some misophonia sufferers will hopefully have tuned in and learned something. I don't think it's appropriate to do anything like that.
I don't think it is. Hopefully they've gotten through the first few sound effects of the part one and howling monkeys and all that sort of stuff. But it was very, very, very interesting. Jane's a perfect advocate for the science as well, being a sufferer. Yeah, I don't even know if that's the right phrase. And the researcher. I love the idea of research. And I was thinking as she said that I don't suffer from misophonia, but everybody should be able to relate to it, because there are certain things. And the one that does it for me is tape off a cardboard box.
Oh.
You remove the tape off a cardboard box, I get goosebumps and get that. I don't mind nails in the blackboard, but something visceral happens to me for that.
Right. And interestingly, would you get angry if I...
No, I don't have the fight or flight thing. But it's like I actually can, the hair goes up on your arms. It's really strange.
Okay, Well, actually, I have that with a nail brush. I don't even know that they exist anymore, but there was a time in the 80s when nail brushes were everywhere.
Yeah.
That sound of, and even the concept now, I can feel it on myself now, of brushing nails with this little wiry brush thing. Like I cannot deal with that.
It's funny because we should all be able to relate to misophonia, because everybody has something that they don't like. And then it's on that scale. you know?
Yeah, just multiply it out, exactly.
But multiply it out, and it's a fear, and it's anger, and it's panic, and all the rest, as Jane so eloquently explained. Well done, you. Great episode.
Thank you very much. She is brilliant. And as I said, if you do know anybody even who might you think might have misophonia, get that book for them. It's just brilliant. It really is. And get the audiobook as well, because as Jane said, they chose the perfect person. And do you know what? It's actually really funny. Like, it's genuinely, like, I laughed out loud a good few times, because she often punctuates scientific research and new discoveries with stories like, I wanted to punch my husband's face in because of whatever. So it's there's a humor element to it as well, which I think is a key part in coping with misophonia. But yeah, that's my episode this week. Neil, what have you got for us next week?
I'm going to tell you why you'd paint a raccoon to glow in the dark.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that.
I will. I'll tune in for that one.
Stay tuned.
All right. Nice one, Neil.
Talk to you later.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.